This is MSCI Perspectives, bringing to light insights and analysis that help global investors tackle today's challenges. I'm your host, Adam Bass, and today is April 11, 2024. To achieve the ambitious climate goals set by investors and different regions around the world, you have to figure out what to do about coal-fired power plants. And like much in life, the answer to this particular puzzle is not nearly as simple as it may seem. Our guest today recently looked into different scenarios and pathways for phasing out coal and replacing it with renewable energy sources, including some of the trade-offs that policymakers, companies, and investors may need to consider. Here's that conversation. So to start us off on this conversation about phasing out of coal, let's go back to the beginning if we can. And Manish, I'll start with you on this one. I think it's fair to say that on an intuitive level, most people understand that coal energy production and, let's get more specific, coal-fired power plants, these are large contributors to climate change, regardless of how you slice it, right? But can you quantify the impact that we might see from phasing out these kinds of plants?
Thanks, Adam. So let me first introduce myself. I'm Manish Shakdwipi. I'm part of ESG and climate solutions research and focus on the solutions for asset owners and investment manager in the Asia-Pacific region. So yeah, coming back to your question, yeah, I agree that while we intuitively know that coal-based energy and power generation are major contributors to climate change, let me put some rough numbers to this. So out of total energy-related carbon emissions globally, coal accounts for more than 40%. And out of those, roughly two-thirds of emissions are due to coal-based power generation. So definitely, coal-based power generation is a major contributor to climate change. And these power plants, if not phased out, could eat up a significant portion of remaining global carbon budget. So for instance, in a business-as-usual scenario, coal-based power plants in the Asia-Pacific region could consume more than 40% of the remaining 1.5-degree-aligned global carbon budget, and that's substantial. However, with a phase-out in orderly manner, roughly three-fourths of those future emissions from these power plants could be avoided. And that will make a significant positive contribution to the global efforts towards mitigating the worst impact of climate change. And these findings that I just mentioned are from a report that we published in November last year at the request of the GFANG, which is Glasgow Financial Alliance for Net Zero. And in this report, we discuss possible pathways for the phase-out of coal-based power plants in the Asia Pacific.
Why APAC specifically? Why was that your focus?
Yeah, good question. So the APAC region actually accounts for more than three quarters of existing coal-based power generation globally. And if we talk about the plant capacity or the capacity which is coming in future, Asia Pacific region accounts for 96% of that future capacity. And this makes this region significantly exposed to coal-based power generation. At the same time, major countries in the region have committed to net zero. So some countries have committed for 2050, some for 2060 and 2070. And these commitments expose like these assets to emission reduction regulations in the medium to long term. And that's the reason why we focused on the Asia Pacific.
So you mentioned the two scenarios and started to talk about them a little bit. But before we dive into how you went about conducting your research, what you found, you know, let's define our terms, as they say, in terms of business as usual. That was scenario one, right? And then the managed phase out scenario. How would you define those for folks?
So business as usual scenario could be understood in terms of what we are seeing happening currently will continue to happen in future. When we talk about the coal power generation in the Asia Pacific, what we assume that firstly, in the BAU scenario, existing coal power plant will continue to operate at the current plant utilization rate. Secondly, plants which are in pipeline, so those basically under construction and pre-construction stages are built and are operated as planned. And finally, coal plants are retired in their retirement year if disclosed. And if it is not disclosed, then we assume that these power plants are retired at the end of 40 years of their life. Now coming to a managed phase-out scenario, so the first major change that we assumed in this scenario is that plants which are in pipeline are halted immediately and are replaced with solar or wind-based renewable energy power plants. And as far as existing coal power plants are concerned, they will continue to operate at their current utilization rate, but will now have a limit on their maximum operating life. And at the same time, these plants will also have a backstop year. Backstop year means the year by which all coal-based power plants are phased out in that country. So in our report, we assess the range of values for these two parameters, which are like the maximum operating life and backstop year. And this resulted into a number of MPO scenarios for a given country.
When you say the 40-year assumption, is that the average life of a coal plant? Is that where that number comes from?
Yeah, this number is sort of like a standard. It has been used by many other, international agencies as well. So if you look at the reports from different agencies like International Energy Agencies or some other global agencies, they also use this number in case, it's a technical life of plant. Elshin, do you want to add anything here?
Basically, yeah, it's often easier to shut the coal plant and build a new one if it's really old, because it cannot compete with similar plants in the region, because the old plants will have more or less similar cost of fuel, so the hard coal or lignite that they burn. And the biggest differentiator and competitiveness of those plants is how efficient are they in converting that fuel, raw fuel, as in coal, into energy, electricity in this case. So, that's why it's often not economical to operate plants beyond 40-year life. Not that we've never seen these cases, but often that's around the age where they are replaced. You can operate them a bit longer, especially if you do some retrofits. But at the end of the day, it's sometimes just easier to start from scratch, particularly when you have some local emission rules on SOx and NOx and particulate matter that you need to be abiding by.
Thank you for that added color, Elchin. And actually, Manish, I appreciate you pulling Elchin into the conversation, but for the sake of our listeners, Elchin, can we just take a second and can you introduce yourself, please?
I'm Elchin Mamadov. I work in ESG research and I focus on analyzing utility companies.
Excellent. Thank you. We're really thrilled to have both of you on. By the way, this is such an important topic. Let's dig into those scenarios and your findings as you worked through them. Again, invite both of you to jump in here. But Manish, let's keep going. We're kind of on a roll. Let's start with you.
Yep. So the key finding of our study was that there will be a sort of trade-off between the speed of transition and reduction of emissions. So for example, if a country goes for phasing out coal power quickly, which will maximize reduction of emissions, but may require a sudden ramp up in renewable energy and risk of disruption in the energy supply, faster closure may also negatively affect employees, suppliers, and surrounding communities, because these all stakeholders depend on the economic value created by these plants. And to address these social issues, countries may think of phasing out coal slowly, but then it will delay the transition at the cost of more emissions. So basically, countries need to strike a balance between speed of transition and reduction of emissions, between potential environmental benefits and the social challenges. And for investors also, this presents a balancing act situation, as they also need to decide between whether to meet their environmental objectives in the form of emission reductions and minimizing asset stranding, or pursue just transition by addressing social issues also at the same time.
There's a trade-off between the speed of coal phase out and the speed of decarbonization. But what we found is that some countries are in a better position than others on some of these metrics. So for example, certain countries may be able to achieve a quite orderly phase out if they cap the plant age at 30 years, whereas other countries like China and India and also Indonesia would be able to achieve the most orderly phase out if they cap the plants at 20 years maximum. So they won't operate the plants for more than 20 years and to shut them before 2040. These are one of the key findings of our report.
When you looked at different regions, Did you find any differences about where they stand in terms of the impact of a managed coal phase out?
Our research showed that India is the country that has the easiest or least hardest task of delivering their decarbonization through managed coal phase out. So they're going to get the biggest bang for their buck through managed coal phase out, whereas other countries may find it a bit harder, either because they already have a huge legacy coal-fired power fleet, or because they are not decarbonizing fast enough due to coal representing a high share of their power mix.
And Elchin, in terms of different countries moving at different speeds, what's the impact there for investors? What should we take away from that?
In terms of investors, there's a stranded asset risk that all of them consider, especially those with net zero targets, if there are large financial institutions. But even if they don't have those targets, the stranded asset risk is real. And particularly in the fossil fuel space, such as coal-fired power generation and mining. And basically, you should think about the stranded assets as a risk for assets to suffer from unforeseen or premature devaluation or write-downs, right? And that poses a potential risk to decreasing shareholder returns. The risk factors are three-pronged. So you've got like economic factors, such as the cost of coal may rise, and we've seen the cost of fossil fuels spike during the Russia-Ukraine crisis, but also the relative cost of coal-fired power generation versus, let's say, renewables may change where the coal is priced out of the market. There's also potentially a higher cost of funding and ensuring those projects going forward, right? And not only for new projects to build, but also for existing coal-fired power plants when it comes to refinancing their debt, for example. There's also physical factors that are in play when it comes to these risks, and particularly in places like India, which suffers from high water stress. You need a ton of water to cool down these power plants, and that could be an issue, particularly during droughts, but also during floods. And finally, you get the regulatory risk factors, right? So if a country comes up with a tougher climate change policy, more ambitious NDCs or nationally defined contributions, and tougher emission standards and higher carbon taxes. So these are all like regulatory risk factors, and they could all lead to a stranded asset risk, which investors are trying to incorporate in their assessment of companies.
Manish, any other insights into stranded assets? And actually, if I can ask you to start with, again, I know I'm asking for these types of things often during this conversation, but can you define stranded assets for us as well?
So if you go by the textbook definition for stranded assets, it is the loss of an asset's value well before its useful life. So when we talk about asset stranding in the context of coal power plants in the Asia Pacific, on the one hand, what we see that companies are building new power plants, but on the other hand, respective countries are committing to net zero emissions and are putting carbon emission reduction targets. And this misalignment between countries and companies, actually what it may lead to like the stranding of coal power plants, because these coal power plants, if they want to meet the national emission reduction targets, then yes, there could be like the emission reduction targets on these coal power plants also in the medium term, and thus like they need to operate at lower say operating capacity or the lower utilization rate, and that will lead to like the loss of the asset value for those plants.
Elchin, you also talked about the sustainable energy projects and how that plays in, because of course even as we phase out coal, the energy demand is not going anywhere. In fact, I would imagine it's probably continuing to rise with the way modern life is proceeding. But where do those projects come in? Solar, wind, et cetera?
In order to deliver managed coal phase out, you need to replace the energy that is currently generated by these fossil fuel power plants, namely coal, with something else, with an alternative. And renewables and battery storage are one of the ways to achieve that. And in absolute terms, the largest potential opportunities are the largest coal-fired power producers, right? Like China, India, Indonesia, and Japan, if we're talking about the Asia-Pacific region. And while for some of them, the amount of renewables that you need to increase as a percentage of current capacity is not as much. So in case of Japan, it's only 50% they need to increase their capacity in order to be in line with their managed phase-out pathway. In many countries, especially the large ones like India and China and Indonesia, you need to more than double or at least increase by more than 1.5 times. Again, in other cases like Bangladesh and Laos, it's almost triple. So the current renewable capacity. So we're seeing huge opportunities for growth in investment. So it's not only about the risk, this coal managed phase out, but it's also as much about opportunities in those markets.
Let's stick with that for a moment, Elchin. As investors are evaluating companies within different markets and even across markets and different countries and regions that have different goals, different carbon reduction targets of their own, regulation, as you mentioned. From the perspective of an investor, what is the impact for how you make decisions? You know, how you're analyzing which company to put your money into?
I mean, you have to pick your battles and you have to do your homework, right? So in terms of looking at where to put the money, you could look at it as a potential opportunity to generate additional income or to make an impact or both, right? If you're focusing on impact, it may make sense to pick the dirtiest power plant owners, right? So the utilities with the highest share of coal in their power mix, existing power mix, or the companies that plan to add most coal-fired power plants going forward. And our report lists them, so you can take a look. But it might be difficult in some cases because a lot of those companies either privately held, so you cannot invest in them through equity. You can maybe influence them if you hold the bonds that were issued by those companies or if you provide them loans. And again, some of those companies are also state-owned or state-controlled. Again, your leverage as an investor may be limited. So you need to pick a battle in terms of seeing, okay, which companies are already on the way to decarbonizing or are thinking to start that process, which of them don't have an outsized role of the government, which of them are operating in regions where countries do have this more ambitious targets versus other regions within APAC. And that would all define how much engagement and influence you can have as an investor in those companies. The other way we can look at the problem is, again, to shortlist the companies to engage with is which of them have the largest gap in decarbonization pace between what they said in their sustainability reports, those companies, versus how fast the country where they are based is decarbonizing and where most of these assets are. And we did find that it's not necessarily the company with the most ambitious decarbonization target that is at risk. You're more at risk if you're operating in a country where there is a very ambitious decarbonization targets, for example, Australia or Japan for that matter. And even if your pace of annual decarbonization rate might be more ambitious than some of your peers in APAC, you're at a greater risk because of this gap between the country's decarbonization targets and the company's decarbonization targets. And one of the roles that the investors are performing these days is to try to point that out to companies and their management and try to get the conversation going.
Now, it sounds like you were at least a little bit surprised by that finding. Why is that? And why do you think that the actual finding turned out to be the case where if there's more ambitious targets, that there's more risk for the companies within those countries?
As I said, it's very tricky that some of these companies are the interest they're trying to manage, right? If you have a coal plant that is not brand new, it's been mostly or fully depreciated, any profit that you're making out of that plant is pure profit, right? Any money that you're making. So to tell your shareholders, look, I'm going to shut this money-making machine because I do also have to worry about decarbonization might not be an easy conversation to have, right? So that's why we're seeing this push. And the other one is a pull where the countries came up with this like targets, but especially if they don't control the companies that operate within those countries, and those companies are owned by private investors, not all investors appreciate 2040, 2050, 2060 decarbonization targets that the country is on the hook for. And therefore, the acceleration, the decarbonization pace in those companies may not be as fast as you would expect, given the countries they're operating in.
And of course, many of these investors, many of these institutional investors specifically, they have carbon targets of their own for their portfolios. I'm curious, what's the advantage then of investing in coal plants at all? Doesn't that just keep their portfolios dirty, so to speak? Why would they just not divest, let's say?
Yeah, so simply choosing to divest may expose investor to market risk, at least in the short to medium term. So as we know, like in many of the these markets, which have committed to like a net zero of by 2050, 2060, 70, but there isn't, say, the short to medium term target. So even in the short to medium term, there are no stringent emission reduction target on the companies. And thus, like the companies, coal-based power generation companies are not exposed to like the major regulatory risk in the short to medium term. And that's one reason why I'll say investor may want to remain invested in these companies to reduce the market risk. But at the same time, remaining invested in these companies actually give investor opportunities to engage with the companies and understand, communicate the long-term risk these companies faces, and make a positive impact in terms of influencing their carbon emission strategy and reduce their future emissions. And in this entire process, you rightly said that yes, they could like simply divest from the companies and reduce the portfolio emissions, but by investing in the coal-based power generation, they can actually influence the strategy of the companies, influence the future future carbon reduction plan of the companies. So basically, create a positive impact. And because of the company's positive action in the medium to long term, investor may also see like their on portfolio emission getting reduced.
Elchin, anything else on that front? You talked a little bit about investor engagement earlier.
Yeah, we've seen some companies in APAC that have grown their coal capacity by 45% since 2017, and already coal accounts for 40% or more share in their electricity mix. So these could be good candidates for engagement. And in fact, we've seen already significant engagement activities by certain investors, such as Asia Investor Group on Climate Change. They've managed to engage with companies such as Tenaga and Percero, and after the engagement, those companies have committed to retire some of their coal plants earlier than planned. Another company, Energy Australia, who was also a subject of that engagement, has also put out a $5 billion Australian dollar action plan to transition. As a way to do that, they plan to shut their coal-fired power plants earlier and expand into renewables and energy storage quite aggressively. So engagement does produce results in some cases. You just have to pick your battles.
And Manish, earlier when you were talking about the report that you and Elchin put out, you mentioned that it was done at the behest of, in partnership with, the GFANS organization, which I appreciate you spelling out and not just using the acronym there. But what role do organizations such as GFANS play when it comes to the carbon phase out?
So first of all, even I would say creating an sort of an investor group and talking about this topic where basically you can invest in the transition assets, which if you really go back to four to five years or 10 years, people investor or in general like the stakeholder were actually talking about say divesting from those. But given that transition assets are important for the broader economy, for the broader portfolios, it may make sense to like remain invested in some of those and then create like the positive impact by working with them. And so just by creating an investor group and then talking about like these topics, creating awareness, and then taking the like tangible actions, creating the plans. Tangible action is important.
And so we have this comprehensive report. You've followed up with a blog post quite recently focusing in on the engagement portion. So I have to ask, in either or both of you, please jump in here. What's next? What's next on your radar? What are the kinds of questions either you're asking or investors are asking of you?
It's a long battle. So Manish has explained really well the work that organizations such as GFunds are doing to promote the managed call phase out. But to summarize, we live in an age where a lot of people have a very short attention span. So if you're a financial institution and on paper your financed emissions are going up, even if it's temporarily, and you have net zero target, you would start get questions, especially from journalists, but also from other investors. Why is that? So the company is having to explain a lot. And the more support they have from organizations, not just GFunds, but also Rocky Mountain Institute, and also IEA and others, in trying to get some practical advice on how to mobilize and scale this high impact coal managed phase out project and strengthen their credibility, the better. So that those kind of support that these organizations are providing is everything from guidance on what mechanisms to use, how to think about this problem of managed coal phase out, which has a lot of trade-offs, and also even like what metrics to use. So for example, GFunds came out with a concept of, or at least promoting concept of expected emission reductions and avoided emissions. So these are KPIs that they do want the financial institutions to use to showcase the work that they're doing in addressing climate change. But also they pay a huge attention to the social dialogue and stakeholder engagement that we talked about today, and also like to make sure that the companies have transition plans in place. They consult with workers and communities. They provide an adverse impact fund, because some of these coal power plants, they're huge taxpayers locally, so somebody has to pay for schools locally. So it's not an easy task, and the organizations and financial institutions are working together in order to not divest, but rather ensure the real economy decarbonization through this managed coal phase out.
Well, thank you very much, Elchin and Manish, both, for a very interesting paper, very interesting conversation, and thank you for coming on and sharing your insights. Hope you'll come back again. That's all for this week. Many thanks from Joe and me to Manish and Elchin, and to all of you for listening. You can access the full report on a managed coal phase-out called The Value of Speed and Order in Asia's Coal Phase-Out at msci-institute.com, and the blog post that focuses in on investor engagement at msci.com. Next up on the program, MSCI's Chief Research Officer, Ashley Lester, leads his quarterly roundtable on the themes investors are focused on as the year continues. Until then, I'm your host, Adam Bass, and this is MSCI Perspectives.